Good day, everyone, and welcome back to Cutting Carbon. I'm your host, Jeff Goldmere, and joined, as always, by my host, Brian Gutnick. Brian, good day.
Hey, great to be back again, Jeff. We've got an exciting topic lined up today. Eager to get into it. To me, what excites me about today's topic is, while we've been talking a lot about ways in which we can slow the pace of carbon emissions and things that we can do to even stop them, but today we make the step of actually going to things and technologies that can actually reverse climate change. So super excited to get into it.
Today we're going to talk about direct air capture, and we're joined by Carlos Hertel. Carlos is the Chief Technology Officer at Climeworks AG, which is a Swiss company which is offering a system for direct air capture. That's how to take carbon dioxide out of the air. Previously, Carlos was the Chief Technology Officer and Chief Information Officer for GE Europe, driving new product and technology initiatives in the region. He studied aerospace engineering at RWTH Aachen and the Technical University of Munich, where he received his doctorate. So, Carlos, welcome to Cutting Carbon.
Thanks for having me, Jeff and Brian. It's fun to be around on the show.
We're so looking forward to the discussion. So before we kind of start diving into the technology around direct air capture, Carlos, we introduce you as you're the Chief Technology Officer for Climeworks AG. Can you tell us a little bit about the company?
Oh, the company is still a startup in a sense. Well, let me say it's an early stage company with the ambition of solving the problem of climate change by technical means. And that basically meant this carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has to come out of it again. It's the driver of most of what we see in terms of climate change, and a machinery that could take it out of the atmosphere and sequester it safely somewhere would be exactly that machine that reverses climate change if deployed at large scale. The company has grown nicely. We have about 150 people, all the way from technology development, plant engineering, marketing, sales, all the functions that you do need. And the company is headquartered in Zurich. It also has a small outlet in Cologne, an engineering site, and it has a site as well in Iceland, where our latest plant is at this very moment being erected and to be commissioned very soon.
Great. So, Carlos, let's start with the beginning. Direct air capture, or DAC for short, what is it?
Well, fundamentally, direct air capture is doing what the natural world has been doing for a long time. It's taking the carbon dioxide straight out of the atmosphere. Now, why is that something worth emphasizing? You can take CO2 also from the sources, from the industrial sources where it's being emitted. Think of power plants, chemical plants, think of cement plants and others. We would refer to that as point source capture. And that's an industry in itself and something which is gaining a lot of momentum. What we do is we're capturing the CO2 basically there where it makes the trouble, if you will, namely out of the atmosphere. Now, why is that a big difference? Chiefly because the CO2 in the atmosphere is in fact highly diluted. No matter how potent climate effect it has, the reality is the gas is very diluted. It's actually a trace gas in the atmosphere, and that makes taking it out technically quite a challenge and requires some smart technologies to do it.
I want to follow up on that point. I remember being in school, and it was maybe junior high school or high school, and we're taught that the atmosphere is made up of oxygen and nitrogen, and there was no kind of rounding. It was 21% oxygen and 79% nitrogen. Kind of doesn't leave any room for CO2. So I guess it's there, but when you say trace amounts, do you have a specific number you can share with our listeners?
It's indeed very small. I think few people are aware of how diluted it actually is. It's 0.04%. So very small. The 400 ppm that you often hear about, which is growing, I mean, since pre-industrial times, has been growing from the 300s, now in the 400s, and on its way further up, it's just 0.04% of the total atmosphere. So it's really very little indeed, but it has a strong effect nevertheless.
So Carlos, paint a picture for us. What does one of these systems look like, and kind of how does it work? Break it down, how you're actually capturing air and what you're doing with it.
Oh, sure, Brian. Let me walk you through that a little bit. So you start out first with moving a lot of air around. Since, as we just discussed, it's so highly diluted, you got to move a lot of air to capture a lot of CO2. So the systems will have large fans that suck in air and move it through an array of filter materials, which are in various shapes and forms. They could be embedded in certain frames. There could be basically a PEG bed, which is very similar to other industrial reactors that you would see with granular materials. And these beds consist of materials that have a preferential affinity for CO2 in the atmosphere, right? So if you pull the air through, the nitrogen, the oxygen, and all the other things do not stick to it. They just pass right through while the CO2 is going to stick to the surface, and that's why you could call it actually a filter for CO2. Now that goes on for a while until the filter material is saturated. You would need then to close the chamber in which that filter material is integrated, take out the remaining air, and then heat up the chamber. And there's various ways how you can do that. We typically do it using waste heat from other sources. In our case, in Iceland, it's geothermal heat, but at relatively low temperatures, so say around about 100 degrees centigrade, which I think is kind of like 200 something in Fahrenheit, if I'm not mistaken. Heating up the material means the material releases the CO2 again. The binding isn't strong enough to keep it there permanently, but the heat actually releases it. And that means you can now, in the chamber, collect the CO2. You can purify it if needed, and then you move it somewhere else where you either can sequester it in the earth, or you can use it for some processes that create renewable fuels or renewable chemicals. Or you could actually also put it into a beverage plant, and then you have beverages that are enriched with carbon dioxide, as many of our soft drinks are. We actually have a plant in Switzerland that is serving one of the drink manufacturers in the country with CO2 captured from the atmosphere rather than taken from chemical plants or from the environment. Other uses would also be enhancing the growth in greenhouses. Now, that's, again, a market that does exist. It's not a very large market, but the same plant in Switzerland that serves the beverage industry also serves one farmer who is nearby the plant, and he's receiving the CO2 from our capture system.
So, Carlos, if I can ask a follow-on question. This filter membranes that have this affinity for CO2, once you've kind of stripped that CO2 with the heat and released the CO2, can you reuse these filters over and over again, or is there some number of cycles by which you have to then replace those filters?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because fundamentally, yes, you can reuse them. It would be a very expensive proposition to replace them each time they have been saturated. So you can replace them, but they are sensitive to temperature and they are sensitive to degradation mechanisms that put some constraints on the process you can use. So let me casually say, if you drive them too hard, they degrade faster. If you operate them much more carefully, they live a lot longer. But you can easily imagine there has to be an optimum somewhere. Right? You can have these lived forever, but then you may have a plant that becomes very big and doesn't capture much. Or you drive it very hard, you save space, you save capital investments, but then you have to replace your sorbent. So it's a bit of a play between capital investments and operating costs. And there are, depending on environmental conditions and depending on the specifics of a plant, you may have that optimum slightly shifting each time that you build another plant.
So, Carlos, I've got two questions for you. So one, I'm going to take from the skeptic's perspective. You know, we'll hear people say things like, we'll just plant more trees. Why isn't that a rational solution? And maybe the other way to say it is, why do you need direct air capture?
So let me first emphasize how important it is to plant more trees. Reforestation, afforestation is of the essence for a number of reasons. And capturing carbon is one of them, but restoring ecosystems, ensuring biodiversity, and many other reasons speak for having more plants. But if you look at the various reports from the IPCC and from other organizations, you recognize that if you make an assessment of how much potential for carbon dioxide removal the various approaches have, you very soon find that it needs a portfolio approach. Not one approach alone can cut it. So you need natural methods, you need technological methods, and on top, you of course need a lot of decarbonization going on in industry. So avoiding emissions in the first place. If you don't avoid emissions, no air capture and no planting of trees is going to help us. So all these things need to come together.
We agree a portfolio approach definitely is needed. A second question on, when we talk about once you have the CO2 captured from your system, you then do something with it. You've cited some examples of the beverage industry, using it to support greenhouse production of fruits and vegetables and plants. But I think ultimately the large application has to be either storage or permanent sequestration, that there's just a limited number of end-use sectors for the CO2. Can we talk about what happens from a geological perspective? Do you have to be sited near in certain locations that allow or have the right geology?
Well, yeah, it's correct. I mean, there's a variety of geological storage sites that lend themselves for permanent sequestration of CO2. It could be aquifers, it could be depleted oil and gas reservoirs, in a sense. We are having another way of storing it permanently, and that's what we are doing in Iceland, namely injecting the CO2 in basaltic rocks. And the very conditions in Iceland allow for a very fast mineralization, basically turning it into stone. And that goes in a matter of years, rather than in some other locations where it would happen naturally too, this being a process that goes on over centuries or maybe even longer time frames. So that's what we do in Iceland, but that's not the only way you can do it. And certainly I think we will need a variety of storage options in various places around the world to sequester all the carbon that is today in excess in the atmosphere and needs to come out again. So let me just add one more thing here, and that is the storage does not have to be where the plant is or vice versa. The plant doesn't have to be next to the storage, although it is advantageous in that you save the transportation component. But there's already hubs being developed in Europe and I think also in the US where the CO2 is being collected in a sense and then brought through pipelines to a very large central storage facility in the Northern Sea and elsewhere. So you could also be hosted somewhere near to a port where this is being shipped into the pipeline. So there's a variety of options. I think for now, being close to a sink is a big advantage, but I think looking into the future, we'll probably have also sites where there's no direct sink, and yet you can still build a plant because the infrastructure is in place to transport the CO2.
So the keys there would be either if you're not next to the sink, having the infrastructure nearby to transport the CO2 to the sink.
Yes, exactly. That's what you would typically do then.
You're listening to Cutting Carbon. I'm your host, Jeff Goldmere. If you have a question on today's episode, a question on decarbonization in general, or a suggestion for a future episode of this podcast, drop me a note. You can reach me at cutting.carbon@ge.com.
So, Carlos, how many of these direct air capture systems exist today, and how much carbon are they capturing? I guess it maybe be my first question, and maybe the follow-on to that is what's required for it to scale and grow even faster?
So today, right now, the only company that has systems in the field under regular field operation actually is Climeworks. There's a couple of more companies that have announced plans to build commercial operations in the field, but so far we are the only one who have done it. We have in total 14 plants spread out across Europe, but most of them are very small. They have the character of pilot plants, exploring different climatic conditions, exploring different application use cases for the CO2. The one plant that really is a commercial plant for CO2 removal, where ultimately certificates, if you will, are being issued and where things are being also certified, the plant is itself being certified, in the process of being certified under gold standard. That's the plant which we are currently commissioning in Iceland. And that has a nameplate capacity of about 4,000 tons per year. Now, that's already a sizable plant for us, but by the standards of what it takes in the future to reverse climate change, that's a very small plant. So we've got to bring this up in steps of, say, scale-up steps of about 10 or so over the next two, three generations to come into the range of around about a megaton, so a million tons of CO2 removed around the 2030s. I think that's what it takes. And from then on, this is not the end of the journey. What you need to remove ultimately is then, again, maybe 1,000 times that. Right? Ultimately, if you look at the numbers that the research societies have been publishing and the associations, and you recognize we need to remove, as of 2050, something between 5 and maybe up to 30 gigatons, which is 1,000 megatons, and a megaton is 1,000 kilotons, so large, large numbers we're talking here, up to 30 gigatons per year need to be removed from the atmosphere.
So presumably cost is the biggest challenge. As you had articulated earlier, by having such a diluted stream versus capturing it more at a concentrated source, I think, is the challenge. What do you see as the opportunities for breakthroughs in cost? Clearly, one will come with volume. You can get some productivity and scale that way. Are there material inventions, things that need to happen that you see as a major breakthrough?
Thanks for the question, I'd say, since that is an important one to discuss, I think. There's a variety of factors that play into the cost equation. And it starts with, rightly as you say, it starts with scale. This industry is a nascent industry. It's just emerging, if you will, even if our company was founded 10 years ago, as a serious proposition. It's really only emerging right now, in the last few years maybe. So you do not have a tailor-made and competitive supply chain around it. Every component that you would buy, everything you do is, I mean, let me describe it as almost handcrafted, right? Whatever you need, that's a special thing that you can't just easily buy off the shelf. You have to find someone who do this for you. And that makes it naturally expensive because it is sort of almost like prototyping, which is always expensive. Even if the serious product is relatively cheap, the prototype of that serious product, look at the automotive industry, tends to be a fairly expensive thing. So we are lacking scale, and that means we are lacking a supply chain that co-invents with the OEMs that we are and the companies putting it in the field. But that's not all. You're right that there's also the question around the new materials. And the core material that matters the most is the filter material. Unsurprisingly, you would say, right? It has to be. The holy grail of the whole thing is, can you have a material that has a very high capacity of absorbing the CO2, that is very long-lived, that doesn't make much of a resistance in the system, so I can easily move the air through it. And ultimately, of course, it also needs to be relatively cheap. It can't be arbitrarily expensive. So innovations on the side of filter materials, I would say it's picking up at a very fast rate. You will see many research institutions, universities, but also companies coming forward with new proposals. Some of them variants of technologies that have been known for a long time. Some of them radically new approaches that people only started researching because they recognized it's a problem, but it's also an opportunity for us to come up with a few good solutions. So in summary, it's the filter material, it's the process design around the filter material, it's finding the perfect location with the right low-cost energy supply, and then ultimately scaling it up, which is going to take care through learning curves of the remaining reduction in cost that will be needed.
So as you envision direct air capture, as we've talked about, going to larger and larger scale because there's so much CO2 ultimately that has to be removed, do you envision then there are these modules and each module has a certain number of elements and you just start building more and more of these blocks, these modules, and that's kind of how these large scale direct air capture plants would look? A lot of these smaller elements all combined, or all these small modules all combined together to make the big scale?
Yeah, so Jeff, this is the approach we have taken. Let me emphasize what advantage it offers. That is, if you have modular solutions in your typical 40-foot shipping container size, you can have that mass produced. And that's what's going to bring costs down. This is a little different from many other industrial process plants, if you will, that say, I have to make my components bigger. My cracker, my heat exchanger, my other functions that I have, the bigger I make them, the more scale advantage I do get. And that is certainly true. In our case, however, we rather go the other way and say, like, let's make it a meaningful size that's also easy to transport, and then rather bet on these components being mass manufactured.
So I think of this almost like a Lego system, right? You have individual elements that you combine into these modules, and then you can stack modules upon modules upon modules. And I maybe can envision this assembly line where each of these individual components, the filter material is put in, the fan is put in, all the controls are put in, and at the end of the assembly line, these individual systems are then stacked together into these larger modules, and larger modules are stacked upon each other in the field to create what would be some large future direct air capture system.
Right. So it has two aspects which I would like to add. The first aspect is you can build smaller and larger plants very easily. You can configure plants. And it's unlikely that plants will be all of a massive size. It depends on local conditions as well, right? I mean, you need a certain energy supply to it, you need a certain space around it, maybe your sink that you have has a certain capacity because it's being used for other carbon removal projects as well. So you want to have some flexibility and not each time design a system from scratch again for yet another size, right? Modularity has that advantage. And the second piece with the modularity is it's actually not all modular. So if you look at the plant in Iceland, in Helisheiði, our orca plant as it's called, you do see the modular pieces, but there's also a central processing facility, which is kind of a building in which you have a lot of the further components that you will need. And those components are typically specific to a certain site. So if you have, say, 10 collector containers or 100 collector containers, your central processing unit components will look different. There may be an air liquefaction system in it. You don't want to have 10 of them, you want to have one of them. There maybe is a heating system, a steam generator, there may be cooling systems, a vacuum pump. Those things will typically scale like industrial equipment does, but the very capture unit, the collector container, that's the one that's being modular.
What do you see is the global acceptance of direct air capture? Are you seeing governments and advocacy groups come into realization that direct air capture is a critical and necessary technology on this journey, that it's gaining that needed level of acceptance?
I'm not the perfect reference here, since I have other colleagues in the company and that are looking at more at the political space and working with NGOs and other interest groups. So it's kind of like secondhand information what I'm giving you, but I also say that from my own personal contacts, it has changed a lot over the past 5 years. I'd say it has not been part of the broader discussion 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago. It is very much in focus right now at this very moment. You see it a bit on the political debate, but less so. You see more of it actually in the private sector. The number of companies that make pledges for net zero to be carbon neutral is increasing by the day. Companies like Microsoft, I mean, those which are public, right? Of course, we can also mention Stripe, I think, and Shopify, and a few others have come out and said, like, we recognize it takes a solution that needs to scale very fast. Let us help this industry to develop quickly so that things will be ready on time. This does not replace political action in any way or form, but you can recognize that something that maybe companies would have looked at as an outlandish idea just 5 years ago becomes part of their own carbon solution portfolio today. And that is simply just a reflection of the different tone and the different recognition that you have in the public debate overall.
One of the things I noticed, Carlos, in doing some research for today's episode, I spent some time on the Climeworks webpage, and it appears that for individuals who are interested in effectively offsetting their own carbon footprint, Climeworks offers a sort of solution for that, correct? Can you maybe explain that for our listeners?
That's absolutely true. So you can, I mean, if the listeners are interested, you go to the Climeworks website, and there is a web shop, in a sense, where the company offers a subscription model for pioneers, as we call them, because they truly are pioneers, individuals who go in and say, like, I want to compensate for my carbon footprint last year or to a certain extent, and this is one of the concepts which I want to support. And it's quite astonishing how well that's being received.
Carlos, I think the subscription service that you offer is fascinating. I was on the website as well, and I was delighted to see you have more than 6,000 pioneers, as you described, really setting that personal example to inspire others to take action. So I think that's fantastic. A question for you. Do you see an opportunity to take this same technology and perhaps apply it for other greenhouse gases, maybe methane, others? Is that something that Climeworks is looking at?
Not at this very moment, since the chemistry is very different for the different gases you have in the atmosphere. And for CO2, I think by now we have a very good experience. I think fundamentally you could think of taking other gases out of the atmosphere as well, of course, but you would have to have probably very different systems and very different reaction processes that would have to govern it. So what we do really is exclusive. And the good thing is it's so exclusive to CO2 that you can pump through the system any gas composition you want. What sticks to the filter material is only the CO2. And you really want that. You don't want to have any confusion, since if you want to sequester it or use it for other purposes, you want it to be as pure as possible. But it's a very valid question, Brian. Not to my knowledge that anybody in our company has thought about doing something else but CO2 removal.
Carlos, who do you envision your customers are? Are these countries trying to achieve certain carbon, levels? Are these investors looking to monetize the carbon reductions? Are these private entities, or all of the above?
So at this very moment, I think the market is an entirely voluntary market. You have seen the pioneers, right? You gave that example that individuals who just out of their own initiative want to remove and come and work with us. But the majority of, I would say, the volume that we do sequester and take out of the atmosphere is basically done and sold to individual companies. As I said, I mentioned a couple of them. There's others who are not publicly known. But so that is the current voluntary market. I think the voluntary market is going to help that industry take the first important steps of scale-up, of maturing technology, of developing a footprint, of developing practices around everything from where to build, how to sequester, how to make sure it stays there where we want it to stay. So that market is extremely important. It can move faster than regulated markets can because it doesn't take many parliaments and governments to take decisions and coordinate. In the long run, however, I got to say that without a regulated market, it's going to be very hard to reach the enormous volumes that have to be removed. So government action and public action, if you will, societies have to act on this in a very decisive way over the next 5 to 10 years. Before that happens, I think the voluntary markets are the one driving it, but they cannot possibly stem it on their own. There has to be a much bigger play. My best example I can think of, since I've myself lived through a good portion of the renewable energy revolution, if you will, is governments at some point recognizing if we want this to become an option in the future, we have to basically help it grow and help it stand on its own feet.
This has been great, Carlos. Carlos, any last thoughts for our listeners today?
So I'd say time is of the essence. That's what I want to leave everybody with. You might think this is an early stage technology and there's a few startups pushing this forward and we got to wait and see what happens. The reality, I think, is 2050 in industrial timescales is basically around the corner. So if you want to bring something from, in our case, from a few hundred thousand tons per year removed to a gigaton per year removed, you need a 20 to 30 time scale up of the industry year after year with expanding capacity. You just can't switch it on overnight. It has to grow, it has to learn, but scaling up industries is also very capital intense. So I'd say nobody should take that as an interesting idea, and we'll see over the next 10, 15 years how it pans out, but it's something that needs to become a reality very soon, and then hopefully we'll be ready to make its contribution by 2050 when it truly matters.
Great, Carlos. Thank you very much. Again, for all of our listeners, if you want to learn more about Climeworks, please check our show notes for references available. I want to thank our guest, Carlos, and thank my co-host, Brian Gutnick. This is Jeff Goldmeier, and this is Cutting Carbon. Thanks for listening. If you want more information about today's episode, check out the resources available in our show notes. I'm your host, Jeff Goldmeier, and this is Cutting Carbon.